Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 32, which is a special episode brought to you from the Organizational Learning, Knowledge and Capabilities Conference 2017, held in April this year in Valladolid, Spain. For this episode, Ralph sat down with Professors Mats Alveson and Bjørn Erik Mork to discuss Mats' keynote speech about his book, Stupidity Paradox. We previously touched upon this work in episode 28, and you may recall that this book, a signed copy of it, was subject of our first ever prize draw, the winner of which was Jared Damon from Sydney, Australia. To get more information about the text, about the guest, and about the podcast in general, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. But for now, please enjoy this conversation.
This is Dr. Ralph Soll. I'm here at the Organizational Learning, Knowledge and Capabilities Conference 2017 at the University of Valladolid, Spain. And I'm joined by Bjørn Erik Mork and Mats Alveson. And we're going to discuss Mats' recent keynote presentation about functional stupidity, as well as other things that we think came up during the conference that we thought were interesting. So, Dr. Mork he's a professor of business management at, I'm going to mess this up, but he's going to help me. Business management in Norway and at Oslo at the business school there that actually hosted OLKC 2013. And he was actually a prominent figure there in the organizing committee and helping that run. And I'm very grateful for both of you today agreeing to be on the podcast recording with me. So Dr. Moore, did you want to add a little bit more to the introduction? I'm sure I didn't get that all correct.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honor. So I'll located at BI Norwegian Business School, and we had the conference at BI in 2014 in Oslo.
Oh, that's right. Dr. Alveson was a keynote speaker at the conference. He was our final keynote speaker for the day. He's a professor of business administration at the University of Lund in Sweden, and also at the University of Queensland Business School in Australia, at the CASS Business School. He does a lot of research on knowledge-intensive organizations, leadership, identity, organizational image, organizational culture, qualitative methods, and philosophy of science. His recent books that we're going to discuss, the most recent one today, The Stupidity Paradox, and he's written Managerial Lies with Stefan Svingensen, and Triumph of Emptiness, Qualitative Research and Theory Development, and many more. It would take me much longer to describe. So thank you today, Mats, for joining us.
Thank you. Good invitation.
So the keynote that Matt gave today was related to his book, The Stupidity Paradox, and I have a copy of the book, and I encourage the readers to go buy it. Matt's pointed out, you can actually get it by going through Heathrow Terminal 3. It's prominently featured there in the bookstore. So, but if you're not Heathrow Terminal 3 anytime in the near future, then you can get it online. I got my copy from Amazon. And at the introduction to the book, which I won't give verbatim, but I did think it was interesting, Matt's was talking about how he got the idea for writing the book. And it was meeting a colleague at the conference, and they were sitting down to discuss various issues. I think it was over dinner is when that occurred. And somehow the conversation of the stupid organizational things they've seen in their careers has come up. And during the course of the conversation, and Matt says in the book, this is one of the ways he gets ideas for interesting research to do, which is a good note for our listeners. He and his colleague were kind of taken aback by all the many quick examples they could give of things that their organizations were either doing or they had seen that seemed patently obvious on the face of it, just stupid ideas or stupid things to go do. And so I won't necessarily recount all the examples, because he actually has given some during the course of the keynote, and I can talk about those as we get up to them. But essentially, as he and his colleague were having this conversation, who's also the co-author of the book, they took a scholarly interest. They went from the complaining mode — this is what I find very interesting — so they went from the complaining, catching up mode, to, I wonder why this is, And the realization that people don't generally come to work to be stupid. That's not, nobody actually thinks about doing it that way. And this gap that they saw between what are we doing kinds of questions, which very quickly you get into the functional stupidity kinds of questions or examples, and the why are we doing it? You know, why aren't we more reflective about what we do? And so in the nature of the book, I do want to ask about the title, kind of how that came to you. But just for the listeners, essentially the essence of the title, functional stupidity, conveys the notion that even though some of these things look at face value as stupid, they're very adaptive. They're very functional. They help organizations get things done and maintain focus. So there's that recognition by the authors that it's not just patent stupidity. And he gives examples of the difference between functional stupidity and basic stupidity. I forget the exact
pure stupidity.
Yeah, so that was a good one because that's ignorance and I don't know what I'm doing and I'm completely outmatched. And so he just distinguishes functional stupidity from pure stupidity. And so I personally thought it was very interesting this idea of looking at how in the short term functional stupidity is actually very adaptive and effective for organizations because they get things done, but it may not be so in the longer term because it causes organizations to be maladaptive and you do things that drive your good talent away and maybe does not help you to respond to crises. So what I was going to ask Dr. Alves is my first question, or just to get us started, is you had the conversation with your colleague, and then you decide, hey, this is when did it come to you that this is something we should pursue further, or either write a paper or a book on? How did that occur from as a part of that conversation?
Yeah, well, both myself and my co-author Andre Spice from Cass Business School. We have an interest in critical thinking and critical management studies. And then, of course, you tend to doubt then the rationality of organizations. So one assumption is that most things that go on, they are rational, they are functional, sometimes productive. Counter assumption is that a lot of things, they are there because of habit, tradition, received wisdom, imitations. Some people become very enthusiastic about a peculiar idea, and then they kind of implement that, and then it's there, and then it continues to live without any particular good thinking backing that practice up. So we both are a bit critically minded, and then I think that after a couple of glasses of wine during this dinner, then you feel a bit more bold and free in your thinking. And this relatively drastic statement, organizations that are quite often stupid, are they not, came up. And we thought that, yes, they are. And it's not just exceptions. It's quite normalized, and it's a normalized type of stupidity that often is seen as quite reasonable, rational, acceptable. People don't try to do that much about it. And it's not so simple that it's only irrational or stupid. It also has some positive functions, as you mentioned here, Ralph, and therefore we coined the concept functional stupidity, which is very different than from pure stupidity. So if people are doing something obviously really stupid, then there's normally a sanction following from a clear feedback loop, making people wanting to fix the situation and reduce that form of stupidity. But we have an enormous amount of stuff where people are following fashions, they are buying into the most hollow statements about visions or values or becoming religiously then fascinated by the idea of leadership that should solve all problems for people and so on. So there's a lot of this normalized, institutionalized functional stupidity that is tricky sometimes to spot, and we need to be much better in identifying this, thinking about this, and perhaps often trying to do something about that.
Right.
So the idea was that irrationalities and peculiarities, they led to this idea of stupidity as a strong statement, then indicating we should take this much more seriously.
It's a very useful way of thinking about what's going on in organizations. And as Mats was mentioning during the keynote, also the reference back to Feldman and March, if these organizations are that rational, why do they actually gather lots of information afterwards? What do they do with all of the information and then all of that? I think this is a very useful development of some of these ideas and explains what's going on. Many organizations tend to see that we need to be matrix organizations. That's the solution, and they don't think about the problem. You have the belief right now the hospitals and the universities should be bigger and bigger. No real proper analysis. Why? Is it better for the patients? Is it better for the students? I really enjoyed the presentation.
Well, and one of the comments that Matt's made near the end of the presentation is sort of an example of the functional stupidity is that it relates to the universities, this idea that fashions are pursued over accreditation and these things that have to be done because of the accreditation agencies. And you were given the example of asking, why are we doing this? You know, why is this important, right? And then there was this response was kind of reflexive, or well, everybody else is doing it, and we may be judged negatively, and of course, in my particular case, I always like to ask, well, where's your data on that, or is it something could we collect data on that, as opposed to just saying I'm worried about what may or may not happen. And we'll talk a little bit later about some of this possible anecdotes or things that not antidotes to some of this functional stability that I thought were interesting and I'd like to explore a little further. But Bjorn, I was also interested in, do you see some of these kinds of examples of functional stupidity in the consulting work? Because I know you do some consulting work.
Yes, it's, for instance, the way they organize their organizations, they seem to have the solution immediately. And also consultants seem to have the solution that we need to go for this particular model. And also the way they work with strategies using really big buzzwords rather than going into depth and saying, what is it that we're trying to work with here? So, seen many examples, both from the consultants, but also from the clients.
Sure. And so we'll come back to that buzzwords thing, because that's actually one of the antidotes that Matt was talking about. When you and I were talking at the reception the other day, you mentioned that there was this case of a Norwegian company that was merged or bought out by an American company, and then the headquarters got moved to the United States, and the senior managers, we've talked, because it's kind of an example of what you were talking about, they learned that in Norway, because most of the workers were still in Norway, and the senior management found out that Norway has more enlightened maternity leave policies, is probably the best way I can say it. I know Sweden is similar, than we have in the United States, which the directors were aghast about because of the differences. Could you retell that story?
So the issue was that the company had been very successful in Norway, and they saw that a lot of the activities could also be successful probably in the U.S., so they expanded their activities. And the issue was then for the HR director when the top management team, the executive team, was in the U.S., and they heard about this rumor about this father's leave or parental leave in Norway.
Yes.
And then it didn't make any sense that the top management team in Norway would actually have time off because they became a parent. So they were asking, like, okay, I can hear what you're talking about. How much is it to get? How much do we need to pay in order to fix this? And then the response was for the HR director, this is actually rules and regulations in Norway. Yes, I can hear you say that, but how much are we talking about? So they did have like strange conversations and weren't able to solve this because apparently they had very different mindsets on this.
Right. Well, and of course, one of the things that made me think about that when you were giving the examples of functional stupidity is there was really no, didn't sound like from your description, Bjorn, where there was a point where the top management team or the HR director in the U.S., was saying, why don't we try to do it like Norway, or where's the value of doing it differently, or how might this attract employees differently than we're currently doing? There was this, well, this is what we do, I've never seen this done before differently, and so I'm just going to question that as opposed to kind of rethinking my assumptions, which I think is part of one of the examples you were giving about how to spot functional stupidity, which I'm going to discuss briefly. And so that's what I thought was an intriguing example, even before you'd done the keynote, about I think some of the symptoms of functional stupidity. And speaking of symptoms, one of the things I thought was interesting is you had some slides about spotting functional stupidity. And I'm going to go over them briefly, but I wondered, did you notice the irony during the question and answer period when somebody asked you specifically, how do you spot functional stupidity? So I thought you were very deft in the way you handled that. You didn't say, well, you didn't see slide 3 where I actually gave that list. So you actually answered gently and then kind of referred to the fact that it was one of those examples that you had given spotting functional stupidity. So as a speaker and somebody who values irony and humor, I thought you would appreciate that.
Well, we have humor in our strategic plan in Lund University. I mean, now we also have it perhaps involuntarily so, but at one point the strategic plan said that we should support humor at the university. And I tried to, I don't take the strategic plan particularly serious in most cases, but I think that idea that you can work with irony in research and education is a good one.
Yeah, and I like that. So one of the things I like about irony sort of being dual purpose, right? So there's a humorous aspect to it, but I think you would agree with me that it also means you're thinking differently about this, and you're it gives you a chance to kind of reframe the nature of the issue and maybe in some ways that it's safe to kind of question it. So you could say, well, if you got upset and were taking me too seriously, it really was meant to be a joke, but maybe not. And if I don't take it too badly, then also it's a chance to get me to rethink or reframe the problem. So that's why I think
that irony is very important. My background, as I mentioned before, is partly critical studies, and I tend to see like the dark side of things. You see organizations as iron cages or psychic prisons or something. And that, I think, is often a good starting point for critique. But sometimes you can also approach phenomena with humor and an irony, and there's like a small critical element in this. Sometimes for a change person, if people are not too kind of seriously stuck with an idea, you can see it from an ironic angle, and then it facilitates some type of at least mild critical distancing to the phenomena. So I think that we talk about leadership and strategies and human resource management and entrepreneurs and so on, that we could sometimes do that with a nice glimpse in our eyes rather than being so bloody pretentious. And,
that's interesting. That's interesting. So it's a flash of insight as well as critical critical theory approach.
Yeah.
That is very interesting.
Yeah. So I once published an article called Leadership, the Great Disappearance Act. So people normally believe that leadership is there when you have leadership styles or identities or values or authentic leadership or strategic or charismatic, transformational, whatever. But when you look very carefully at what managers actually do, they do a lot of admin.
Yes.
There's a lot of operative issues.
Mintzberg has found that out. Yes.
All the stuff on managerial work.
Yeah.
They find that there's not so much leadership. There are other things. But then if you approach it with leadership, then you have this like pretentious notion. And then, but you look carefully at what managers actually are doing, then it tends to poof, it disappears.
Right.
So it's good for people's identity boosting. I'm a leader, not a manager. And it's good for the leadership industry. They can sell a lot of fantastic leadership development courses and so on. Well, this is fine. The problem is that the phenomenon is relatively rare because large-scale organizations, there are a lot of admin operative work with IT issues, admin and all kinds, financial reporting, a lot of meetings and so on. So it's not that much of this kind of pure and fantastic leadership that everybody would like to see there if you really believe in that kind of thing.
Well, and that's what I've seen in my practice world. So before I got my doctorate degree from the George Washington University, I was in the Navy for 30 years. So, of course, lots of functional stupidity. But actually, it's very, very functional in what they do. And I can give a couple of examples of that would be similar to your Pepsi Coke example you gave in the presentation, because I would like to get some feedback on that. And I've often thought as a practitioner, or when I was and still am to some extent, that distinction between leadership and management that people like to make is not only very artificial, but also, like you said, it's a kind of a way for consultants to sell their ideas and publish books. And I never felt like, well, one day or 15 minutes I was being a leader, and then over here I'm being a manager, because they just tend to blend together. And Mintzberg and a lot of his writing says, Who wants to work for a leader that's a bad manager, right, or can't manage very well in the sense of getting things done, you know, efficiently? And then who wants to work for a manager that is a bad leader or ignores leadership such that you don't know where you're going, you don't know what your role in the organization is, you're, you know, unsure about the kind of next steps ahead. And so I think that's a good way to look at it, that in many ways it's an artificial distinction.
I completely agree that it's we need to have a much more nuanced description of how that actually rolls. But as you mentioned, it's good for selling leadership programs. It's a very good way of encouraging the students to apply for our programs, trying to learn
marketing. The yeah, there we go.
So I think it's just a way of packaging and black boxing something, which are much more complicated in
practice. And there's a functional aspect to that, right? So you can get your business to run, your business model work. So one of the examples I was going to give, I'm going to give a functional stupidity as a Navy example. And my colleagues in the Navy, you have to take this with a thick skin. So we designed the ship. The U.S. Navy designed the ship called the Littoral Combat Ship, or LCS for short. So the way the ship design process works is it's two groups. People set requirements. I want the ship to be this long, this big, displace this many tons, be this fast. You know, those kinds of things. And then they do what we call throw it over the fence to the engineers, and the engineers take those requirements and they say, okay, well, that's a hull this big, it's this much steel, this many welds we'll have to have, these are the kind of weapons we'll put on, here's the propulsion system it needs to go through the water that fast. So we there were many challenges and difficulties of communication in this whole process, but when we got to the end of it and the ships are actually produced, the designers went back to the operators, the ones who set the requirements, and said, how do we do? How is this looking? It wasn't quite that formal, but it was essentially like that. And the operator said, well, you know, it doesn't actually go out in the deep blue ocean. And the engineer said, yeah, but that's not what you asked for. You asked for a fast ship that can operate near the coastal waters, and it's a different design. And then the operator said, well, I don't know if we need it to go this top speed, which I can't say out loud. And the engineer said, but that's what you specified, or that's what people 5 years ago specified. So I saw some of this going on before I left out active service, and I thought, what an amazing knowledge transfer case study, because actually the people who are asking those questions about, I don't know if it needs to do this, were not the ones who set the requirements 4 years hence, but because of the processes involved, and many big companies had this. It's not like you could go back in time and change what we had done. I mean, we have the design, and so it's not just inconvenient to ask those questions. Now you have multi-billion dollar shipyards poised to start producing these things in high numbers, and we're asking these questions. And so if you said, well, you know, let's go back and rethink that design, you'd have to lay everybody off, right? So there's a functional aspect of saying, okay, even if it's not exactly what you think you want today, we just need to go make 30 of these things and maybe make minor modifications, but we're not going to completely change the design, because it takes too long, the other ships are going to wear out, and you'll shut down the shipyards because they exist to make this kind of work. So I was thinking before I read the book, which I do have, that's very functional, because you just can't go in and say, oh, I wish we'd done a different design or what have you. But what you could do is say, and this is something the U.S. Navy is not very good at, you could say, well, it's interesting that these questions are being asked at this point. Should we go back and look at our design process and try to understand why we did this, or what the momentum was, or how do we get in a situation like this? And I haven't noticed much appetite for that, because when you go back to that, the logic of the money and the billions, people are really focused on, let's get the money to build these things, and we should be building them. And those kinds of ironic, strange, you know, questions just aren't very high on their list of priorities of things to ask about.
Most organizations that have poor memory, they have limited interest in really learning that much of what went wrong. And then in many cases, then you have people then protecting themselves and then looking forward and see what can I benefit from in terms of my career moves and having my position safe. And it's not necessary to engage in careful investigations. How come we ended up like here, and what can we learn from this? It's a good organization actually should be extremely good at learning from mistakes and from problems, but there's a tendency that very high up on the agenda. There's one study indicating that after consultancy projects, there are never really any evaluations. What happened here? what was the outcome of this? Can we learn something from this to the next time? To move on to the next project, which probably will be as half successful or even miserable as the last ones.
Right.
But they're forward-looking rather than backward-looking. But at least it's not that much so more complicated learning that is so necessary to produce good organizations.
Yes, and that example you give the consultants was also something similar in their presentation about the different views managers and the consultants had about some change that didn't work. And it reminded me of one of our listeners for the podcast who told me that before he started his graduate program, he was a consultant. And he would write these reports saying how the business's logistics and management processes weren't supportive of the organization. They needed to be updated, and they're having these kind of difficulties. And he would finish the report, give his PowerPoint presentation, go away, do some work with other corporations, and then he would get invited back. And they would basically be doing the exact same thing they were doing before. And he wanted to ask, well, why did you invite me back if what I gave you wasn't something you wanted to do? He said, well, we'd like to hear your ideas. And so at a certain sort of functional level, you could say, well, maybe management, the top leadership is building some case for making some kind of change or something. But of course, he got very frustrated by that. So he decided he could improve things by go getting an advanced degree. And then maybe they'll do what he says. I'm just teasing. Sorry. You know, if he has the advanced degree. But I was thinking about that. Because I've read some material that says that consultants essentially don't do anything special, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but they will usually just come into your organization and talk to your people and find out what your people say are the problems of the organization, and then they kind of bundle those things up, package them, and say, here's what you ought to be doing. And that was really part of what you were getting at when you have this information, but you're not focused on learning and just getting things done. So companies sometimes pay people come in to give them some fresh perspective, which I think is adaptive in a certain way, unless you just don't use it. And then you kind of wonder, what's that perspective for? I mean, what do you think about that?
I think it's correct. And the interesting aspect as well, though, is that what I have discovered since I have had this joint academic role and consultancy role is that clients become very surprised or somewhat upset if you challenge them and not deliver exactly what they're used to.
Uh-huh.
Because if you come in more with an academic approach and you ask all the questions, they are surprised. This is not what they expected. But as I've seen that they appreciate it if you can challenge them and then also bringing some of the academic approaches, asking more critical questions, what's really going on here. But I definitely think that it's easy for these companies to just deliver whatever they normally do. And learning from failure is one of the issues, I think, which is very important. And that's also, in many companies, that's part of the incentive structure. You will not become a partner in a professional service firm by telling that your last 10 projects failed. So that's sort of the issue as well.
Okay, so professional development aspect, like you were talking about.
So I think the career aspect is very relevant. As you say, Mats, it's not necessarily the best thing to tell.
We once did a study called Changing Organizational Culture, where we followed a change project in real time and across different levels. And for us, it was apparent then, as we were talking to a lot of people there, that nothing was really happened. But top management, they thought that they started this program, and then it works like an eye-opener, and then everybody will have workshops, and they will continue to work with these questions. But lower-level employees, middle managers, and so on, they did these workshops, and then they wrote a brief report, and then they assumed that top management would do something.
Oh, interesting.
In the next step. But right. both sides here, different parts of the organization assume that somebody else will drive this project forward. And so what was absolutely not the case, but I think that we were the only ones, as we were doing this in-depth research, that found out that nothing is happening. They expect somebody else
That's
to do
amazing.
This.
Yeah.
And then we had a meeting with some senior managers, and then they started by saying to us, we're very interested to hear about your observations and conclusions, And we have understood that the people are working on this, and it's kind of well received in the organization with a small question mark afterwards. And I said, we said that not really. Our very kind of firm conclusion is that that is not happening at all. And this was what seemed to be happening there. And then they withdrew from any responsibility. They said that we entered this relatively late, and it was top management's, they own this process, and we are not been so involved in all this, etc. And it was very clear that they didn't want to hear this.
Yes,
they were much more protected of not knowing and then bury the mistake rather than taking on board this, we thought, relatively fundamental insight regarding what's happening in organizations with this clarity, who is supposed to do what is not necessarily there. So a lot of issues, they disappear in the multitude of things that people are supposed to do. But they were not interested.
That's amazing.
They protected themselves, yeah. and that is it. And not spreading, we are perhaps involved in this failed project, or top management is blamed for that. No, it's much better to bury the mistake and then go on with something else. Possibly do the same mistake next time as well. Actually, we had a presentation for some other managers from this very large international company. And then after having gone through this example and discussed it, one of the managers in this course, he said, it ends like this every bloody time. I think that this is standard operations. But the people are not so interested in learning or improving here because it calls for some extra moves.
Right. Well, and of course, I do have some sympathy for the senior managers because you only have so much attention. You have to focus it in certain ways that ship the product today. And I do recognize that. So in the U.S. Navy example, when you're trying to ask some of those kinds of questions, one of the things that people spend at the very senior levels a lot of time on is framing budgets, justifying budgets, and then defending them against sort of internal cuts. I mean, because once they're cut externally, there's not much you can do about that. And therefore also demonstrating progress that justifies those statements that you made. So, you know, when I look at that, I say, kind of makes sense that you would do those kinds of things in order to keep the organization going forward. But it does make me wonder, well, would anything cause you to stop? So typically, and I wonder if you've seen this in your research, typically the things that really stop people and they have to self-examine and reflect is a crisis or a disaster or, you know, something blows up or you lose $5 billion or, you know, what have you, or you're, you know, Barings PLC and you go out of business because of a rogue trader. And so that's actually not a bad example also of functional stupidity where, okay, we learned all sorts of these lessons where Nicholas Leeson was completely on his own and he was able to cover his own tracks because he was in charge of the security at the firm and defended all these questions. And you go back and look and you say, well, the senior managers were more focused on the profits that he was reporting and not making. And you realize, okay, so the story that you see in the press about, or you might pick up, so I'm not trying to blame the press, that, okay, it was this evil rogue trader and he was just really bad person and a criminal, which in many ways he probably was. What I think is the more nuanced account is, no, the organization was set up to support him and they actually, you know, could have stopped, not necessarily stopped what he was doing, but they actually had an outstanding audit from, I think, 30 or 40 days before, but nobody had taken any actions right now. And I don't know if none of the papers I read said whether managers, anybody was asking the question, well, why haven't we taken action on the audit? Because many of the items were things that he had done. And you say, well, this is, it's not because he was just a bad person. This organization happened to be set up to support him. And then we learned these things afterwards about risk management and controls and security and who should be monitoring these kinds of things. But if he had never made those mistakes or been caught, it makes you wonder if they ever would have made any kind of changes. We would have learned maybe from the next rogue trader, but you may have noticed, I have, maybe that's not the best way to say it, but what I noticed is that there's always somebody like a Bernie Madoff or somebody else who's doing unethical behavior. And it's personally, I think it's the law of averages. You're just going to have some number of these people, but you also have organizations that enable them. And so I was wondering what you think about that. Is that, you think that's another aspect of functional stupidity where these kinds of things enable bad behavior by certain actors in the organization?
Yeah, and I think that when something goes wrong, it's often quite a complicated issue, so a combination of different elements. And then, but then it's very easy to find a simple kind of explanation. And I think that two problems. One is that sometimes it's the scapegoating, or you overemphasize the bad individual, or find another very simple explanation for this. And sometimes also you overreact a bit. So there's a lot of stupidities going on all the time, but they tend to go on under the radar, and then not much attention is being paid. And then there may be an exceptional, dramatic episode, and this causes to catch a lot of attention. And sometimes we have enormous apparatus around solving this, legislation or a lot of inspections or scrutinizing activities and so on. In some cases, it costs much more than the possible fraud or mistakes sure. that you are discovering. So it's very difficult sometimes to find the right balance, partly in terms of explaining phenomena, and then partly in order to address them in a reasonable way. So in Sweden, we just had a terrorist attack.
Yes,
four people were dead, which is, of course, extremely sad, but it's not that many, and that more people are killed in traffic per week.
Every day or a week,
okay. A small country like Sweden per week. But then you should have, 7,000 new police officers immediately to solve this.
Yeah.
In order to meet this threat. But they probably would have been much more better in terms of saving human lives to have 200 more traffic police officers.
Yes, because for the weekly things that nobody doesn't make it, they don't make it in the press.
No, precisely. So you have this basic irrationalities. And of course, if you are a sensible person, then you see through this and try to argue in a reasonable way. But that is this round then in the kind of panic, and everybody wants to have an easy problem and an easy solution, and then you have a focus on this.
Yeah. So right around that same time, but actually it was before this issue in Sweden, I don't know if you had read about this, but they had, during the Semana Santa processions that they have in Spain, which many are at night with lots of lights, or a big part of the celebration or the holiday, I think it was in Malaga, there were people had been in prison before, troublemakers, you might say. I mean, there's probably more a deeper story to it than that, but they had started some. So of course, for these processions, the streets are filled with people. So tens of thousands of people in the street observing this. And what was reported on the press, which is probably only part of the story, but still, it was that these malefactors started some fights, or were engaged in some fights, that then started kind of had this ripple effect in the crowd because of people backing up to get away from the fight. And it wasn't like large numbers of people were fighting. We're actually having very small numbers. But because of the crowds in the street, next thing you know, a stampede occurs. And one of the people said afterwards, they were interviewed, and they said, well, we thought it was a terrorist attack. So we thought there was something going on, or people being machine gunned or run into by a truck or something. So they all started running, and then some number of people were injured from the trampoline. Nobody was killed, but thankfully, but people were injured by the running. And people got their musical instruments stepped on because they have bands that go through the street to do this. And so it's hard to blame people who see this kind of thing going on, being fearful of their lives because it might be a truck or a terrorist or a machine gun or something. But that's the obvious question. Is there a simple response to this, or something easy you can go do? Because there's one of the things I was thinking about when you were talking about this. There seems to be this kind of visceral sense people have. It's something to be on guard against, about simple justice, right? We know who the person was. We know who made the mistake. We'll imprison them, and then we really won't have the problem, and then we can move on to other kinds of things. There's something about that that seems to be very much part of humanity that comforts people in some ways. And so, of course, when you say things like, which is true, more people get killed in a week in certain countries than that happened in this event. You sound uncaring, unfeeling, and it's not very satisfying to people. So forget about whether they think you're heartless, right? It's not very satisfying to people. And there's just something about that putting your finger on what the problem was or the person that seems a very powerful thing about us.
Often you have solutions that are more costly than the problems. And as we are in the university sector, we can let's think about some universities where there are more administrators and technical support than teachers and researchers.
Right.
So you have peculiar effect that bureaucracy is expanding, and that's partly because you can just list all the potential problems, and there should be a structure, there should be expertise, there should be solutions to all this.
Right.
And of course, it fits into the overall logic, and with this assemblage of solutions, then you all the time create additional problems, so bureaucracy, lack of clarity,
right,
alienation, and so on.
Yes.
So in many cases, then the cure is worse than the disease.
Right.
But we have,
but it grows slowly, right? That's the thing that makes it so
slowly
insidious.
Slowly, yeah. And then you feel this, and the unintended consequences, they are there, but they are beneath or beyond the scope that people are thinking. And of course, then everybody's into their particular narrow logic. It's so important with quality control, students' rights, or legalities, or branding, or equal opportunities, or diversity management, and career advising, and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
Anti-bullying, and so on.
Oh, yeah.
An enormous amount of control, yeah, of people fiddling around with their travel expenses accounts. Or,
oh, yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
So you have this peculiar effects, which accounts for parts of this limited rationality or even functional stupidity,
yes,
then of most organizations. I actually have one interesting example of this. We had a seminar with some personnel managers, HR managers, they're called nowadays perhaps, in a large municipality in Sweden. And then one of these 20 had switched job from being an HR manager to become an operative manager. And she discovered all the enormous amount of steering documents they were supposed to respond to. And then she gave them some feedback. Have you any idea how many documents you received that you're supposed to follow and be steered by? Oh, friends, we need to change our ways of thinking. The interesting thing here was the response by the other people. I thought it was very clear feedback from a person that should have some respect for. But the response was total silence.
Really?
Yeah. So they didn't say anything. And it was like an embarrassing statement. I thought that they probably had an interest in whatever peculiar HR tactic or procedure that they were kind of guiding and then starting to rock the boat.
Sure.
Too complicated.
Sure. Well, I had an experience similar to that where I came in an organization and a friend of mine had the same job but in a just slightly different area, a slightly different project. And he would come to me and he would say, do you know the book says that we're supposed to be doing this? And he would come to me about once a week with that because we would get together and talk about these kinds of things. And I said, no, I didn't know that. And I said, he was kind of a by-the-book guy and I have great respect for him. He's a great person. And I said, look, my philosophy is if nobody complains about it, the fact that I'm not doing it, it can't be very important. So I'm going to wait till somebody asks me why I'm not doing it, and then I'll respond. Because I have too many people right now ask me to do things I don't think are my job to worry about the things that they're not asking me about that actually may be written down about my job. So try to take this sort of pragmatist point of view. Next thing I would like to move to is just the you had some good hallmarks or indicators that would help a person spot functional stupidity, which I thought people might appreciate. So I'll just summarize them briefly. Lack of reflexivity, people not challenging the requirements or asking why we're doing things, and you just gave a really good example of that. Lack of justification, people just telling you to do stuff but not explaining why they want you to do that sort of thing, or being annoyed when somebody asks why are we doing this sort of thing. And then lack of substantive reasoning, not looking at the broader picture, and the example of the automobile or car accidents versus the other kinds of rules with sort of a bigger picture look. You know, does it make sense in this micro area to make these changes when we have these other things going on? And then I thought was very interesting that learning can either increase or decrease functional stupidity because you know, learning is not unambiguous, right? We humans decide what we're going to learn from what happens, and so my version of that would be socially determined and negotiated. So, and I used to run into people at work where they would talk about something they had learned, and I was thinking, were we on the same? Were we on the same project that you've learned this and this? I don't see that at all, you know. But of course, that was the world according to them, and to them, it was very rational and pragmatic. And then the sort of this idea of knowledge in general and functional stupidity versus transcending the transactional stuff to look at the broader implications of the kind of questions that you're asking. So I thought you had a great example, which was about the happy students, the aspect of learning, right? So I'll paraphrase it briefly because I thought it was really good. So there's this tendency today we have in education or college or business schools that we want the students to be happy and satisfied because we think of it. There's this tendency to treat students and learning as a business product. I'm making a hamburger, and so I want to make it with the highest quality, and I have all these objective measures, and there's this customer satisfaction aspect of this. And I don't think that's completely wrong. I mean, there's something to that. But I thought your observation was really interesting that, well, is that really what learning is? Is it really a product or a commodity? And in my own personal case, the things I've learned the best, and my dissertation or thesis would be a good example, there was a lot of blood, sweat, and toil involved in that. And a lot of, you know, like, me look at the mirror and say, why am I doing this again? And, you know, what am I learning? And having to put my ego aside, which of course is not very easy when you learn something really important. And I can really tell you the things I learned the best of my life, none of them were easy. None of them were, I would probably say they weren't good experiences in the sense of, you know, going to a department store or buying a car or something like that, where you have this great experience as a result. And yet I completely agree with you that there's this, that may be more of what learning is about. So I think perhaps we're losing something when we focus on, well, we want to make the students happy. But on the other side, right, there is an aspect that, well, if nobody likes our program, then nobody will come and then nobody will pay our salaries, right? So there is I think you have to, like you were talking about, there's a balance to that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think that student satisfaction is an important thing, particularly in the long run. Not necessarily that just after the course you'll feel very happy, which is often an outcome of the teacher flattering them and say you will get fantastic jobs and here is leadership and strategy and you will work with this or going into generous grading and things like that. So you can always suck up for students and they will feel happy. But more important is the learning and more qualifications and intellectual development. So there's an American study called Academic Drift, and they show that students that benefit intellectually from the studies, they read more, they write more, they work more.
Think more critically?
Yeah, think more critically, analytically, make interpretations. They train themselves intellectually, but that's not necessarily the thing that makes it very easy and satisfying in the short run.
Yes.
So I think we need to think in the long run and give priority to the qualifications, real intellectual, critical thinking, and so qualifications rather than student satisfaction in the short run. I think the latter is not insignificant, but it easily drives higher education downwards.
Right, and that's a great example of how it's functional in the short run, but not so much in the long run.
I completely agree. And then the kind of the community that we have here, that's the sort of contribution we could give. But of course, the issue is as soon as someone would come in and trying to encourage more reflection, critical thinking, and different ways of teaching, and then like interacting in a different way with the students, they find it very demanding because this is not what they're used to. So they need to like being told over and over again that it's actually useful for you in the long run, rather than just getting this is the answer and this is how you will get an A on your exams. But they're not used to this at all. But I definitely think that's the value of sort of the approaches we could bring from this old KIC community.
Yeah, in fact, that's actually one of the reasons I come is to get critical feedback and be exposed to new ideas and things to challenge me. And I think if it would be a much different intellectual learning experience if I came and I only heard the things I agreed with. Everybody was saying the things that I already understood. So I went to a session on unlearning. You know, the problems that we have with unlearning. Is it really a concept? Is there any value in unlearning? And then because you can get to a micro level, like, well, how do you intentionally forget something that you? And then you could back up. And I noticed a connection with the people who were doing research on radical change. And they said, that's one of the problems is that you have people maybe stuck, isn't the right way to say it, but following these paths of what they've done, and they can't let go, which is a form of unlearning or, you know, being more receptive to that. So I thought it was interesting to see those different threads that go back and forth in the things that are presented. Last thing I want to cover is because I thought there was some good humor involved in it as well, but still humor with was irony, because you could see that ring of truth in it. So Matt was talking about this idea of how do you reduce or improve functional stupidity, and what are some of the antidotes, which I thought was a good way to look at that. And, you know, the one idea is basically is don't be so authoritarian, you know, be open up, try to be receptive to new ideas. You know, when somebody is asking difficult questions, don't shoot the messenger or don't act like they're a troublemaker. But in fact, maybe that's a signal that you should pay attention to. And in fact, that reminds me of I think it was Pitterick who wrote the article, but it was the idea when you make a change, you should be open to people saying, hey, I've got a problem, or this isn't going to work properly, because they're telling you important information that you can either use to make the change better or rethink what you were doing. So that's actually one of my favorite articles, when they talk about you should use that information because they're telling you that it's an important signal that you ignore to your detriment. And then the kind of thinking about, well, what are the larger implications of what we're doing, right? I mean, we have this sort of micro-level approach, but more broadly, what's it mean? As opposed to getting really narrowly focused on our brand, and which you pointed out was people are very focused on their brand. And I think you've noticed it's not just a business thing anymore, right? People think of the brand of the university or the brand of the PhD we award, you know, those kinds of things. And then the idea is you be anti-slogans. So you did talk about BS Bingo, which I thought was good. But the one that kind of made the most impact on me was sort of the anti-slogans, or maybe the anti-slogan slogans, right? So this idea about, so the example you was, you know, cover your ass kind of thinking. And calling that stuff as you see it, right? Say, oh, you're not really responding. So you're just trying to protect yourself, or trying to protect yourself in the organization. But it's what's interesting about it is it's a kind of an institutional expression, in a way, for drawing attention to the acting too institutionally. Or so that's what I thought was a very interesting irony of that. And then so what I thought, and this is I would like to get your reactions to. In any case, these are balances, right? I mean, we know the idea that because you're not saying, well, you can't do these things because by the nature of calling it functional stupidity, right? I mean, I also think that's very ironic, right? It's stupidity that we'd say, okay, but it works in the near term. And so like that, the antidotes are things like balance, right? You have to kind of think your way through, which means you can't go on autopilot. You have to kind of think your way through. And it's not purely a rational, you know, nominalistic approach. It's, what's happening here? What, you know, what the heck are we doing? That was actually the lead into the talk. What the hell are we doing here, right? I mean, that question doesn't come up very often. It actually is considered scary when people ask it. So that's what I got out of that. The idea about the antidote. So I went all over the place, but I was talking about the antidotes. Sorry.
Trying to follow the argument.
That's my fault. It's just the way my brain works. So I was talking about the antidotes and this kind of thinking of that it helps people realize, where are we? You know, what are we doing? What do you think about that, particularly in light of the research or the things you see in your practice?
Yeah, I've done a lot of research in healthcare, and then what strikes us there is that it's very interesting to see some of these teams working together for a long period. Some of them are more able to open up space for critical reflection about, okay, is this actually the way we should proceed or not? Do we actually include all of the different perspectives here, or do we just follow what one of the groups would focus on? So we do see some interesting example of that, but with this oxymoron of functional stupidity, I think it's...
Do you see things in these teams where you say some are more functional and less stupid than others, where they're asking these kinds of questions? Do you see things that you think characterize them? So if you were going to say, well, I see managers that do these kinds of things, or more, is it reflectivity? Is it some other kind of thing that you see?
I think they do, yes. In Amy Edmondson's work, she talks about the role of the leader.
Right.
That it's a leader that opens up for asking the questions and then creating space for reflexivity and actually taking the time to do that as well, not just running from one operation then to another one, but they actually sit down and they discuss what can we learn from this one, and learning from failure in healthcare is particularly important, of course.
Absolutely. Any kind of final thoughts, or because particularly about the antidotes, right? Because yeah. I thought that was interesting. It's not all gloom, and you know, you get some critical theorists that are basically just talking all the negative aspects. And I'm not purely optimistic, but I did like the idea that there was sort of a back and forth, or a yin and yang, as you were talking about the topic. And so then I thought it was interesting when you kind of came back to this. Because I honestly, it never occurred to me when you gave some of those antidotes, some of which I have used, that that's actually what they, how they can be used, right? So I'm just curious, how'd you come up with those things? Just thinking or what?
Yeah, well, normally I think that we need three types of activities or efforts in order to make organizations function better. We need to have some structure and solutions, rules, whatever. Particular activities, projects. We need to have cultural orientations, so we are prepared then to give some space and to think about issues in a slightly different way. So that we normally tend to engage in. The third level is then individuals that are perhaps educated and feel the moral obligation, not just to follow the flow and be a good and loyal team player. So on these levels, the structure level, the culture level, and the individual level, we need to try to do a bit better. The structure level, I think that we can work with particular seminars, activities, perhaps have temporary roles as truth tellers or whatever. We can have technological solutions where people perhaps can raise issues anonymously and people can vote about this and then see if there are certain issues that tends to be repressed in organizations because it's sensible and goes against authority or whatever. Most people are hesitant to becoming whistleblowers, but if there are technological solutions, you can bring out issues a bit more clearly, perhaps. Then we can work with culture norms and the idea with anti-slogans such as thinking too much can only cause you trouble.
Trouble. Yeah, that was a good one.
If you would have that on posters in the company, of course, people would think that this is one logic and you can understand that, but you have like a critical distinction.
Yes, yes. That's a great way to do it.
And then you may feel a bit more, I should perhaps think a bit more about these issues, and then you cultivate the norm that we should be reflecting here.
Right.
And on the third level, and that's the idea with the book, that I think that concept of functional stability, it's also like a moral statement that we should try to do a bit better, not only being too careful and too focused, but take the responsibility. I mean, we are not normally dragged to gulag if we speak out. We admire whistleblowers on a distance, and normally we hate them if they are close to us. But I think we can try to think through this a bit better and see if we can raise the level of moral standing of people. It's very difficult.
Sure.
But I think that to some extent contemporary tendencies that we should be so mainstream, should be so adaptive, be customer-oriented, team players, be loyal with the organization rather than to a broader purpose.
Right. Well, that's why I like your emphasis on the moral obligation. Because I really believe if you're just kind of focused on the rational objective, here's what I'm trying to go do part, you miss that entirely. So I think that's a great insight, this idea that it's actually a moral aspect of being a leader is being willing to ask these kinds of questions or support that kind of thinking as opposed to waiting to get a whistleblower, something like that. So that's a really interesting insight.
Thank you.
So I want to thank both of you today. This is coming to the end of the podcast. It was excellent to have you on. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a chance to kind of deepen and broaden the insights that you gave at the presentation. This is why I didn't ask you any questions, because I do like to hear my sound of my own voice, but not on a microphone usually. So this gives me a chance to do it in a smaller environment.
Thank you very much, Beth.
Thank you very much.